So welcome back. This is David Wilner.
And Brandon Levy-Sullivan.
This is the Landmine Show, brought to you by Foundation Stone.
And as the afternoon goes on, we get stronger and stronger.
That's it. And we're sitting here in the studio in Efrat. The warm weather has invited here into the studio, and we've invited here into the studio, Professor Aaron Dembski of Bar-Ilan University, who's just written a book. Barnea, tell us about his book.
Yediat Sefer B'Yisrael Be'et Atika, Literacy in Ancient Israel, deals with issues that have not yet been fully engaged in part of the discussion of who knew how to read and write. Was it only in the hands of the scribes? What was the general knowledge of the populace? And an analysis of different biblical statements, no matter where you are in the scholarly scale of when something was written, as the judge said about the Chafetz Chaim, they told the judge, this man ran after a thief and said, I forgive you. The judge in Russia laughed, and the lawyer said, yes, but they don't tell stories like that about you. It's got to be that either the people of the time or it's reflecting an earlier time. And you have, as Professor Dembski, you bring up, we talk about that there was writing on the letters of the breastplate stones. And it's so prolific, the level in which we talk about writing and writing a mezuzah and writing a Sefer Torah. It hasn't been dealt with in the pure archaeological conversation of the Kfar Vradim Bol and the Isbert Sarta Ostrakhan. There are other aspects, as you were saying, as a cultural historian, that have to be brought into play in this question. We're having so much fun talking to you.
Thank you.
A pleasure. You were discussing the spread of literacy that we can document, the South Arabian script, who influenced who, the experimentation, the communication between the parties, and the evolution of the alphabet. Let's hear more about that.
Well, another exciting aspect of the spread and influence of the alphabet is its connection to the Greek world. As we said before, it's obvious that the Greeks were inspired or at least were adopted the Canaanite alphabet. Here again, we see a sort of a tension between the conservative aspects of writing and the innovative aspects to agree with a local adaption of that writing system. So the Greeks ultimately evolved the alphabet or alphabeta, obviously from the Canaanites, but then realized that since they did not need some of the letters, particularly the guttural sounds, they could use them for the vowels. So Aleph or Alpha and Eta and Omicron would become vowel letters.
And that saves me the number of digits, the number of units they need to learn. It makes it I can condense more information or more speech in less writing space.
It means that writing reflects more the speech than it did before.
Ah.
In other words, and more exactly. This, of course, is the basis of the Latin alphabet and what we use in the Western world, as opposed to the Semitic alphabet of Hebrew and Aramaic and then ultimately into Arabic. So what we're looking at is the spread of the alphabet, and then if there are new letters, new consonants or vowels, they're added on to the end of the Greek alphabet. So the Greek alphabet, which is the basic stem, is alpha tau, aleph ataf. You do have four or five letters that are added on the end that are indicative of that they are additions to the basic alphabet. So that you're looking at the Greeks who've taken this cultural product and reshaped it, but not too much, reshaped it to their own needs. Now, that was a big move, and when it happened is not 100% clear among scholars. There are those who say it's back in the 11th century, 1100s. Some say that it's as late as the earliest alphabetic writing, Greek epigraphy, that was discovered dated to 750 BCE. so that they would assume that the alphabet, that's a vast difference. But again, looking at the example of the South Arabian alphabet, which went underground and was dormant for some 500-600 years, we might assume that the same thing happened in the Greek world. So that the alphabet was borrowed early on, say the time of Hiram, beginning of colonization, Canaanite colonization, and then just appeared in what we'd say occasional documents of the 8th century.
Because society changed how it operated?
No, but perhaps, as you said before, they were using papyrus. And that has disappeared.
Limited shelf life.
You made a very important point in the book. You were quoting from a number of different sources that the ability to have language as part of the have a literate society changes the way the part of the alphabetic revolution changes the way people think and what they're able to produce based on that thinking, and will lead to science and culture not just being recorded and written down. It will change how people function. So I'd like you to talk about that for a little bit, but my question in reference to what you're saying is, if I find all of a sudden that this society is moving forward rapidly, is that not an indication that they're using the alphabet, even if I don't have any physical evidence of it? Can I match it to the historical record that way?
Well, certainly the alphabet has an effect, a cultural effect. Whether it has an effect on cognitive facilities is something that is argued, again, among the scholars. The fact that one now can write down and relate to a text, in our later terminology, the sense of midrash, sense of intertextual operation, which we already find in the Bible, is an important aspect of writing. In other words, in Second Temple times, you find writing has been sanctified. In other words, religious writing, it was the Torah or it's the prophets, and then there are contradictions that come up, or terms or words that are not clear and have to be clarified in the light of later pronunciation or later linguistics, so that you have the beginning of inner biblical exegesis, a commentary from one text to another. And this is the product of writing, because there's a written tradition. If it was oral, then you wouldn't feel the changes or the differences that accumulate. An example of this would be in the prophecy of Jeremiah, who prophesies that the Babylonian kingdom will be destroyed in 70 years. And then the second prophecy, which says that the children of Israel will return in 70 years. This is picked up in the book of Daniel, where Daniel is faced with that problem. Well, wait a second. We are now, or certainly the author of Daniel, we are living we are here beyond the 70-year period that the prescribed period that Jeremiah has given. And how come we haven't seen salvation? And Daniel's is answered by the angel Gabriel. In other words, he needs a divine solution. And Gabriel now reinterprets Jeremiah in the light of his own time. So what you're looking at here is intertextual involvement from one text to another, and how a sacred text has to be given renewed or a new spin or meaning for a later age. These are things that evolved out of the writing system, writing things down. Get back to the other question of the spread of literacy, the spread of the alphabet. It's not only towards the Greek world, but also the Arameans adopt the system, and their style is a quick evolution of the Canaanite alphabet, probably because by the 9th century, they were a part of the Assyrian empirical administration. And which so they're
extensive records.
So they're extensive records, and also of in cuneiform, of course, but they were also writing down in Aramaic, of which we have only a few examples. But their form of writing is more of a shorthand. The letters are simplified, simplified forms. And so the alphabet evolves among the Arameans to a greater extent than among the Canaanites and among the Israelites. Now this alphabet, this Aramean alphabet or style, evolves and is taken over by the Arab world. And by the time the Quran is written, you have an Arabic alphabet, which again is of some 28, 29 characters. But since they have adopted the Aramean alphabet of 22 letters, many of their letters are really the same letter for different sounds. In other words, the ba, ta, and tha is the same letter form, but only differentiated by a number of dots above or below that sign. And we have that in Hebrew, and the shin and sin is basically the same letter visually, but it has two different oral forms. Now, in the Arabic alphabet, we see their dependence upon the evolving Aramean alphabet. But what the Arab world does is very interesting. It says we have to reorder the alphabet according to its visual principle. In other words, the forms of like letters come together. So we have Aleph, we have Ba, and then this is followed by Ta and Tha, which is the same letter as the Ba letter,
which we have in Hebrew also, the Ta and the Tha.
Yeah, or but no, sa. No, but yeah. But we this is the two different letters.
I understand.
But what the Arab world goes ahead and does and says, however, in spite of the fact that we've changed the order of the letters according to their form, in spite of that, we're learning the Abjad Hawaz. We're learning the alphabet, Abjad Hawaz, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, and so on down to Zion, the first seven letters. And that's their term for alphabet.
When do they change the order of the letters? At what period?
Well, it's late. It's late because the earliest real work in Arabic letters is the Quran. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's an 8th century? It's a 7th century?
Yeah. That's the end of antiquity.
Right.
I have out of the ballpark question. In the world of Bible criticism, you have the documentary hypothesis and you have current scholarship saying there's a number of redactors. Some people are still with the documentary, but they're talking about, a lot of people are talking about that somebody in the Persian period or a group of people in the Persian period took written or oral sources and composed that which is now called the Tanakh. And that, I'm summing up several years of scholarship in a sentence or two, because this is radio.
Not summarizing. Now, summarizing.
Summarizing.
That's it.
I'm summarizing. I'm feeling summer. Now, if you come on that shelf over there, under the latest bestseller, is a early edition of the Shulchan Aruch, of the Code of Jewish Law, which draws from the Talmud. And in that corpus is an entire body of law of the rules of how to write the Torah scrolls and the rules for scribes. And also, within the oral law, rules for how the oral law is to be dealt with. And our tradition is that Rabbi Judah the Prince made a change because there was no choice and switched to writing beforehand. That's the thrust of Jewish tradition. What I want to ask you as a cultural historian is, I'm going to take a period in the, let's say, the 4th century before Common Era and say, okay, this is the canonized law, now spread it. Get it over to Tunisia, get it over to everywhere. And these are the laws which will make sure that it's preserved as such. It didn't exist as that beforehand. It was different pieces. But I created and safeguarded the fact that today's Torah scrolls are almost identically alike. There's an et here, there's a hey there. There's two lines of cities left out in Reuven. As I think Rabbi Victor Miller wrote, that there isn't any major theological differences that come out of our differences in the scrolls. You can discuss what the meaning of this verse is, but not is there a God or isn't there a God. The basic thing is the same. How can you come and create something which will so infiltrate and become part of the way it's done in worldwide Jewry? You're not talking First Temple period. You're talking early on Second Temple period, the people already scattered. And say all of this is now going to into play and be solid and everybody's taking it on. How could one or a group of people do that if it did not have much earlier roots? I don't understand the scientific basis of the thinking.
I love the question. I mean, it's a great question. I'm just not sure, right, that we have enough time in the 8 minute to answer such a question.
Let me just say a few words about the Persian period and the theories that are going around. People who are coming to that conclusion are basically working on text critical method, and they have certain assumptions also about the development of text and development of religious texts, and particularly of the Torah. Coming to the table as a historian, look for the evidence that might inform me what is the latest date of the Torah traditions. And my evidence points to at least the end of the period of the monarchy. In other words, when Jeremiah, or the author of the Book of Kings, who writes, or at least the first edition in the time of Josiah, writes and is influenced by the Book of Deuteronomy, then I must say that the codified Book of Deuteronomy existed at that time. When Ezekiel is indebted to the Book of Vayikra, or Bamidbar, that must have been before him. In other words, that book must have been codified. When Ezra and Nehemiah have an amanah, in other words, a public stand of acceptance of the Torah, in addition to the other decrees and edicts that they promulgate, and those sections recall both Deuteronomy and the priestly code, then those books must have been before Ezra and Nehemiah in their codified form. So if you look at chapter 9, chapter 10 of the book of Nehemiah and see the form of the amanah and the contents of what they are affirming, then you see that the Torah scroll was already before then. And I must assume that this was before Ezra as well.
Okay. I like it. Fascinating stuff. Okay, so we just have a few minutes before we sign off for today. And
Rejoice, O Youth.
Rejoice, O Youth. That's right. That was the book.
That's
from Rabbi Miller's book. Right, that's where he talks right. about
Rabbi
that issue.
Miller.
Yeah, it used to be on everybody's bookshelf. It was one of the standard tomes in English. But we are sitting here now. We have a world of controversy going on. And we don't have a lot of time, but recently an inscription was found, and we've spoken about this in the past, in Emek Ha'ilah. They're now sitting, and I think this is going to, the direction I'm going to go is going to surprise Barnea a little bit. This inscription that was found in Emek Ha'ilah, the Ostrakhan from Chirbet Kayafa, from the Ilah Fortress, is now sitting with a number of other important historical inscriptions in the Israel Museum. And really what I want to ask you is, how do you think these things should be presented to the public? Because my reaction was, when I went to the reopening of the Israel Museum, that they didn't adequately present the significance and importance and value of what they have there. With the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think it's an exception. And so there's a whole building and a whole presentation made. And so that really is on a different level. But here you have such important inscriptions sitting in the museum.
Fundamental import.
We want to be able to share that with the general public. We want people to be able to appreciate their cultural history. Right? What could be done better to present these kinds of things?
Okay, you agree with the problem?
Yeah, definitely. I agree with a lot of things that have to be If you look at the Tel Dan inscription, that has its own window, that has its own slot. If you look at the Ekron inscription, it is exposed. That porous stone should be behind glass.
And better protected.
Better protected. The Izbitsata, which is next to the Kayafa Ostrica, perhaps it should be placed within its own context. Perhaps a little bit more explanation about it. I'm sure.
And a broken piece of pottery sitting in the back of a shelf.
Yeah. Certainly don't see that, and it's not clear. And I'm not sure that the guides as well appreciate that as well.
Yeah.
Now, this is a question that you should direct to the museum, the Israel Museum, and their people to come to a solution to that problem.
We want to wish you a mazel tov in producing a life's work of learning into a form that people can now appreciate it. What did you most enjoy about the process of writing this book?
Finishing it.
Very nice.
This is a setup, Arnea. Yeah. You can't ask for better than
Very
that.
Very nice.
So we've been talking with Professor Aaron Dembski of Bar-Ilan University. Again, congratulations on the publication of your recent work. And we want to invite you back next month for another edition of Landmines. Check out the foundationstone.
The public one. Not Professor
yes,
Dembski.
Right, correct.
But you're invited too.
Anybody to check out the foundationstone.org website. Barnea, tell us a little bit about where
The book is called Yediat Sefer BeYisrael Be'et Atika, Literacy in Ancient Israel. It's published by the Bialik Institute in Jerusalem, and you can order it online easily. It's part of the Encyclopedia of the Bible Library of that, and the Jesselson Institute of Epigraphy in Bar-Ilan University was very helpful. I hope that they're pleased of having people appreciate writing. This is really something that they appreciated, that Hanan Eshel of Blessed Memory worked on. What are the ancient words that we can pull out of the ground and that we've saved in Jewish tradition? What can we learn from them?
Wonderful. So I want to invite you back again, as I was saying, next month. This is David Wilner.
And Brian Lee Vizelowan.
You've been listening to The Landmine Show on foundationstone.org. Check out the Facebook page of Landmines. And if you have any comments or questions, we're happy to pass them on to Professor Dembski and our other wonderful guests that we have here in the studio.
And Chodesh Tov for Sivan. And may everyone have a wonderful Shavuot holiday.